underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Steve Barry is the author of 15 historical novels. His latest, The 14th Colony, deals with presidential succession, potential disaster at the inauguration, and a real plan never carried out to invade Canada and make it the 14th colony. Barry's protagonist, Cotton Malone, must stop disaster before it happens, which is only a few hours away. Steve's historical novels have been translated into 40 languages in 51 countries and have sold over 20 million copies. It is a great pleasure to welcome Steve Barry to this week's book show. Steve, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be back here in Albany.
What brought you to this particular subject?
I came across it a few years ago when I was writing another novel, The Lincoln Myth. I came across this this interesting flaw in the 20th Amendment to the Constitution and an additional flaw in the 1947 Presidential Succession Act, the way a president, way you succeed to the presidency. And it's a huge gaping loopholes in our law that Congress is fully aware of but refuses to fix, which is kind of interesting. They've actually addressed it three or four times and they just will not fix it. And so I looked at it and I said, you know, that'd make a pretty cool thriller. So I filed it away and held it and I said, I want to do it in 2016 for obvious reasons,
right,
since it's going to be on everyone's mind. And so the subject matter was quite intentional and deliberate.
When did they first start to address it?
Well, the 20th Amendment came in the 1930s, and then the Presidential Succession Act came in 1947. The first inkling of problems with it came, you know, somewhat after that. People realized there were holes and gaps in it. I'll give you one example, just an example. We all know that if the president dies and the vice president dies, the Speaker of the House becomes president.
Right.
I mean, everybody knows that. Here's the problem. The Constitution specifically forbids a member of Congress from being president. It specifically says you cannot do that because of separation of powers. So in order to take the oath, the Speaker of the House has to resign. When he or she resigns, guess what? They're no longer Speaker. They don't succeed to the presidency. And the law, that's the way the law is framed. It actually is framed exactly like that. A huge loophole. And there's even more loophole if the president-elect and the vice-president-elect die before they take the oath of office, then it's really chaos. And that's what I deal with in the novel.
So once you have that idea, then how do you extrapolate and say, this is the story that I want to tell with that little factoid?
And that is a trick. That's what I call the so what. I've got the cool historical hook. I've got the cool, interesting thing that gets your attention. I call that the ooh factor, the kind of ooh factor. Now I got to find the so what. Who cares if there's a flaw in the amendment? What does it matter? So it has to tie into today. And so the way I did it is I came across something very interesting. On June the 7th, 1982, Pope John Paul II and Ronald Reagan met alone in the Vatican for 50 minutes with the door closed. No notes, no record, no nothing. To this day, we have no clue what they talked about. Mm. Most historians agree that they most likely made a deal that day, a deal that they would work independent of one another and they would bring the Soviet Union to its knees. Now, we don't know if they made that deal, but we do know for the next 6 years that is exactly what they did. And so I took that was my so what, and brought it together. And then I came up with this antagonist, this ex-KGB guy, who is, for him, the Cold War never ended. And he's going to pay us back. He's going to pay us back by creating the same kind of chaos in our country that we created in his country. And I came across two other fascinating facts. We know that the Soviet Union produced around 250 suitcase-sized nuclear weapons. To this day, not a one has ever been found. Not mm-hmm. one. Congress recognized this in 1999 and deemed it a credible threat. And now we also know that the Soviet Union had weapons caches stored all over the world. We know that because we found two of them already, and they were booby-trapped when they were found. They are most certainly weapons caches somewhere hidden in this country, still there, but no one knows where they are. So I put all of those together, and that gave me my so what for the 14th colony.
When it comes to that idea of so what, then you also have to put it into the repertory company that you've already established, right?
It's got to fit my world, yes. It has to fit Cotton's world. And it fit well here because I could put Cotton into Siberia and I could put him into the Russia and I could put my antagonist with Cotton. I had my president, Danny Daniels, whose time was over. It was time for him to come out of office. And I knew he was going to come out of office at some point, so this was a perfect time to bring him out. And it all this story actually fit really nicely, but it wasn't something that I just thought about for a few minutes. I thought about this for a couple of years, putting this story together, and I actually held the story until 2016. I wrote it in 2014, turned it in 15, published in 16. That's the way it works in the book business. You stay that far ahead.
And now look what you're competing with.
Oh, yeah. Who would have thought? I would never dream.
Fiction, you know.
I would have never dreamed that we would be where we are right now. And what's interesting is the good thing about what's happening right now is it's on everyone's mind. So people are thinking about it and people are talking about it. And that's never a bad thing when you're talking about current events and things. There's nothing wrong with that. And so I'm hoping this book will be very timely.
Steve Berry is our guest. The name of the new novel is The 14th Colony, published by St. Martin's Press. Tell us a little bit about Cotton Malone, of how that character came about.
He came in my brain one night, just out of nowhere. I was in Copenhagen. I was at Hybrode Plads, which is a big square there. I was in the Café Nordon, sitting on the second floor having dinner. Lovely place. Windows were open, beautiful night, wonderful, and he just popped in my brain. And he's going to be a retired Justice Department agent. He's going to live in Copenhagen. He's going to own an old bookshop right here in Hybrode Plads. There's a beautiful Royal Danish porcelain store there with a 16th century brick front. I just moved it to the other side of the square. He's going to have his shop there, and he's going to have all kinds of adventures. His former profession will just keep coming back to him constantly, and he has to leave his bookshop and head out. And that was the Templar legacy, and he was born. And now it's been 11. This is the 11th Cotton Malone adventure.
And when you say adventure, these are really things that you would, we presume, this character would be really interested in tackling.
Yes. Oh, gosh, yes. He's got to be. And I have to be interested in it, too, because
yes.
I'm going to spend 18 months studying this stuff. Now I have to also make it interesting enough for the reader to be interested in it because they're going to invest their time and energy. And so the trick is to find those cool things that will get the reader's attention and keep them. And I've had things, you know, the Lost Library of Alexandria, the Tomb of Alexander the Great, Charlemagne, clauses in the Constitution, the last emperor of China's tomb, which has never been opened. I try to find these cool things from history that I can weave these tales about, and I've been fortunate so far to find 11 of them.
Why is the history so important to you?
Because history matters. It matters a lot. If we don't know where we came from, if we don't know what happened before, we are destined absolutely to repeat it. There's no question. We're probably going to repeat it anyway, but at least we need to know what it is. We need to know what happened. We need to know where we came from. History is a record of us. It is us. It would be like us walking around and not knowing anything. We don't know where we came from or anything. We imagine how lost we would be. Here we're grounded, we're rooted, and history does that. And I've always been fascinated by it. So I was lucky that when I started writing, I was able to carve this niche with history.
And these are moments that you have chosen, for the most part, are moments in history that perhaps have been forgotten, that we don't know, mm-hmm. and we should know.
Yeah, I do that on purpose. I don't want to do anything that someone else has done. The one thing a writer never wants to do is do what's already been done. So I always do things, you know, that have not been done. Like The Emperor's Tomb is a book about oil, all about oil, that has nothing to do with the Middle East, nothing whatsoever to do with it. But it's very relevant to the consideration of oil, extremely relevant to it. I try to find those kinds of things that are I want to put a new, fresh spin on it. I did an Abraham Lincoln book, The Lincoln Myth.
Right.
But it dealt with a deal between Abraham Lincoln and the head of the Mormons Brigham Young that altered the course of the Civil War, which actually did happen. And I wove a modern-day thriller around that. So I look for those really neat things, and I really want those things that we don't know what happened. Like, what did John Paul and Ronald Reagan talk about?
Right.
I don't know. You don't know. Nobody knows. So I can put my own spin on it.
And this is probably the most talk show-y question that I'll ask you, mm-hmm. but when does history ever get in the way of telling a good story?
Yes, occasionally it does get in the way a little bit, just a tad. But I work around that every way I can. I try to keep the story 90% accurate. If history is in the way, I find another angle to come at from history. I go another way at it. But I will say it's a rare occurrence. Most times I'm able to plug it all in. If I do have to trip it up, which I do, about 10% of the time, I tell you that in my writer's note in the back. That's why I put it back there. So you know exactly what I tripped up, but it's very small. Like in this novel, I tripped up just a tiny little bit here and there. It wasn't a whole lot.
When it comes to Succession, and we read about that, you want us, the reader, to know that that is
I want you to know there's a problem there, that's real. I'm not making that up. And if you go and read more about it, you'll learn more about it. And that's what I was hoping people would do. They get interested in that particular issue. That's why it's very important to me that the cool thing from history has to be real. It would be very simple for me to make it up. It's easy to make something up. Yeah. That's the last thing in the world I want to do. That's got to be grounded in reality. And then I've got to take that. And then even worse, the reality it's grounded in has to be relevant still today.
Your experience is that of a trial lawyer. And I'm curious as to whether you ever thought of that as being the subject of novels for you.
I won't say never, but I adhere to the philosophy that you never, ever, ever write what you know. Writing what you know is bad advice. It's terrible advice.
It's common advice.
It's common, but it's wrong. Instead, write what you love. Now, if what you know and what you love are the same thing, wonderful. That's great. But for me, it wasn't. I was a trial lawyer. I tried thousands of divorces, criminal defense, you name it, I did it. I had countless stories in my brain. But I didn't want to write legal thrillers. I just didn't want to do that. I didn't love it. I loved action, history, secrets, conspiracies, international settings. That's what I loved. And so I gravitated to that. And so I tell folks all the time, go with what you love. You're going to be far more happier that way.
What you're interested in, and also I assume what you like to read, too.
Exactly right. That's what I read more than anything, and historical fiction.
Yeah.
I loved historical fiction, so I merged the two together.
When it comes to that idea of the fictional sense, and did that come naturally to you? Because sure, you have the history, and then you have to create your own world. When you talked about the creation of Cotton Malone, it sounds so that came pretty fully formed.
He did.
To you.
That's rare, by the way.
Yeah,
but it did come to me. The reason why he came so quickly, I think, is I had actually written 30,000 words of a Cotton Malone novel before I went to Copenhagen, but it was not the character that you know now. He came to me that night at dinner in a new form, completely new form, and I went home and threw the 30,000 words away, started the book over again, and it worked. And that's what the Templar Legacy became. So I had a vision of him before, and he wasn't called Cotton either. It was called another name.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ladies in my writer's group told me it was the stupidest name she ever heard in her life. And so I asked her, what did she want to call him? And she said, let's call him Cotton. And so she gave him his name, actually. And it fits perfectly for him.
Do you still throw words away?
Not really. No, I'm not a word thrower away. I threw those words away for a purpose because I knew if I didn't, I might slip back to them. Because I was still new at writing then. I was still getting learning my craft, and you tend to hold on to it. I was like Cortez with his ships when he told his handful of soldiers, We're not going back, boys, we're going ahead. So I threw away, but I don't throw words away. I wrote 8 novels before I was published. 5 went to New York houses. They were rejected 85 times. I made it on the 86th time. And of the 8 novels, I would 3 of those made it to print in entirety. Of the other 5 novels, I've used about 75% of those words in the novels I've written since then. I've seen here, seen there. So I tell writers all the time, don't throw the words away.
As your success has grown, do you ever think or do you ever understand what makes something get accepted versus what doesn't?
No.
Is there any rhyme or reason to that?
No, if I knew that, I wouldn't be here with you. I'd be off on my yacht somewhere enjoying life. No, unfortunately, that's impossible. And you never know what's going to... You know, there's times I write a book, I say, people are going to love this. This is great. And it does okay. And there's other times I go, you know, I don't know. This was pretty cool. It was all right, but I don't know. And it does wonder. It does it marvelous. You never know. You just truly don't know. What I try to do and what every writer should do is write what they love. Write it the best way they can. And give it all they've got. And that's all you can do.
You've always wanted to stay contemporary. So if you write a Lincoln novel, it's still contemporary.
Yes. So everything's modern day. Mine are international suspense thrillers set in modern day with historical hooks. I don't write historical fiction. I get people say that when they introduce me a lot of times. They'll say, historical fiction writer. And that's, no, I'm not. I'm an international suspense thriller writer and has a historical connection. Would I like to write historical fiction? Maybe one. That'd be kind of fun. James Michener was my favorite writer of all time. He was my idol. And so I would love to write a Michener-type novel. No, you know, no one's doing that anymore. No one writes a Michener-type novel any longer.
And the thing about a Michener novel is that it was filled with facts, and it was really long.
And
it was
entertaining.
And beautiful.
I loved it. I mean,
absolutely beautiful.
Only guy I ever saw could write a 200-word sentence. You know, and you enjoy the 200-word sentence.
But it was far from a page-turner.
No, not at all. And that's not John. That's why they're not written today, by the
right.
way. That's exactly why they don't. Michener himself gave an interview right before he died in 1997, and he said that if he had been trying to get published today, he doubt he'd even be bought.
Yeah.
And that was back then. Today, even worse. That's why you can't write the Michener-style novel. People don't have the patience for it anymore.
So when you write these, how conscious are you of the patience as well as the suspense and thriller aspect of what you're trying to sell?
Constantly. You cannot take your eyes off of that. I tell writers all the time, this is a craft. There is a method to the madness. This is not just slopping words down on pages. This is important. You have to pay attention to it. So I'm very conscious of the pacing of a novel, and I spend a lot of time to make sure it paces well.
Steve Berry is our guest. The name of the new novel is The 14th Colony. And that, of course, means that it can't be a formula either.
It can only be a formula from this standpoint, that my books are action, history, secrets, conspiracies, and international settings. That's an international suspense thriller. But every one of my books are utterly different because they deal with totally different subject matters, completely different time periods, completely different everything. The trick of writing a series, and here's the hardest part of writing a series, every single book in the series has to be the same but different. Everyone, the same but different. That's a tall order, and you have to pay attention to those. If you start writing the same, you're in trouble. If you write different, you're in trouble. It has to be the same but different. And in my case, it's same because you have the similar characters, and you have, you know, the world I created is there. But the different part is the what they get involved in each time, which is utterly different than what they got involved in before.
You want us to understand, because when you talk about the history, you are talking about, in this case, in the scenario that you gave earlier in our discussion, is U.S. history. But as you said, these are international novels. So you want them, you want to look all over the world. Your history is worldwide, very global.
I did a lot of international books, and then I've come over to America for 4 books now. I did Jefferson Key, Lincoln Myth, Patriot Threat, 14th Colony, and then next year's book will be domestic as well. Then I'm going back international again. I'm going back across the ocean. But even the domestic books have an international aspect to them. They do have
Soviet Union.
This book particularly does. There's a good chunk of it takes place in Canada and in Siberia. So I have that angle there, but I'm going to go back in 2019 to where I did before, which were just wholly international stories for a little while. I've been doing the American ones because I had all these constitutional clauses that I wanted to explore, and I wanted to do it before someone else grabbed them. Yeah.
How much do you think about that?
A lot.
I have a great idea. Oh, damn it, somebody else thought
of it. I think about that a lot because I don't want to do what someone else has done. Absolutely not. I want to do something that no one else has done before. I mean, I wrote a book last year, The Patriot Threat, using the 16th Amendment as a weapon, the income tax amendment as a weapon. I mean, no one's ever done that before.
Right.
So I like to find stuff like that that is different. And plus, it gets you thinking when you're done, because there's a serious question of whether the 16th Amendment was ever properly ratified. And now you go and look, wow, he's right. There is a serious question here. So I look for those things. I do not want to copy it. Interesting story about this title, though, is kind of fun. My good friend Jim Rollins wrote a book a few years ago called The Devil Colony.
Yes.
And I told him that I hated the title. And he should have called it The 14th Colony. I gave him this title years ago. And he gave it to his publisher, and his publisher hated the title. So they titled the book The Devil Colony. So I held the title and used it for this novel. Because I love the title. Jim actually liked the title, too, but his publisher didn't care for it too much. And so this is a title that was rejected by them, but I held on to it.
In context, what does it mean?
Oh, it means we were to have a 14th colony. It was supposed to be Canada. Canada was supposed to be our 14th colony. We wanted it bad. We invaded in 1775 and got our tails kicked. We invaded in 1815, got kicked again. Canada's the only nation on the planet that has beat us twice on the battlefield. We wanted it so bad that in the Articles of Confederation, they were given automatic membership in the United States if they wanted it. They didn't have to be voted on. They could come right in. That's how bad we wanted it. We also wanted it in the 1930s. There was a secret invasion plan created by the United States to invade and take Canada. If Hitler had taken England, we would have invaded Canada. And that plan was not only created, there were preparations made to implement it, and it stayed classified until 1974. And so that all figures into the novel.
Are there ever ideas that you have or things that you come across in history that are really good, but just not exciting enough?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, there's some cool stuff, and I just said I can't make a novel out of this. I can't make it work. I just can't. You know, and sometimes I'll say that, and a few years later, I'll figure out a way to make it work. So that's why I kind of keep them. I don't just throw them away. But not everything works. It just doesn't all kind of come together. You know, there's a lot of elements that have to fit to be it, because I've got to have the so what. I read a lot of books like mine. A lot of them have ooh, but no so what. Some of them have so whats and no ooh. You got to have both. Mm. You have to have both. And it's very easy to write one of these books with something cool from history, but it doesn't have any bearing today. Nobody cares. So, you know, there's not much of a story there is what I'm saying.
You want us to read the novel and be entertained by it. But when it comes to the so what, how do you want us to process that?
I want you to think about it. I want you to maybe go and read some more about it. That's why I write that writer's note in the back, and I give you some very good references back there that I used. I spend about a week writing that writer's note. I take a lot of time on it. I go through every page of the novel to make sure I give you correct information. So my primary job as a novelist is to entertain you. That's my job. But if I can inform you as well, if I can intrigue you as well, then so much the better.
This goes back to a follow-up question that I was going to ask you some time ago, but it got away from me. But as we wrap up, I want to make sure that I include it, which is, I ask this of journalists all the time who become novelists. How does being a journalist help you in your novel writing? So how does a lawyer help you in your novel writing?
Only from the standpoint of learning how to put a story together, because a trial is like a story. It really is a story. And if you have to tell the jury a story, and by the way, you also have to entertain that jury a little bit. And I'm not talking about doing silly stuff or whatever. I'm talking about making sure your facts, your information, your witnesses, everything is entertaining to the jury so you keep their attention, because your job is to persuade them. And so you learn from that. And that's what I learned from being a lawyer. Other than that, being a lawyer is not much help, because lawyer writing is terrible. Lawyer writing is passive voice. It's very terribly done. you have to get all of that out of your system. And it took me several years to get the lawyer writing out of my system so that I can write in an active voice. And I had to purge that out of me.
The name of the new novel is The 14th Colony. It is a Cotton Malone novel. It is published by Minotaur Books from St. Martin's Press. Steve Berry, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Steve Berry's new book is The 14th Colony, published by Minotaur. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.